Okay, today is June 17th?
Yes.
2015. This is a second interview with Joanne Carr. We interviewed her briefly in 2013 as part of the Academic Staff Institute. My name is Troy Reeves. Joanne, for sound quality purposes, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, my name is Joanne Carr, and that is spelled C-A-R-R.
Okay. Way down. Okay, that should be better. Yeah, that's better. And we can just boost the audio on that introduction and make it sound fine. So, Joanne, I gave you some general topics in advance of this interview. And just start with a very basic general question about your memories about or involvement in academic staff governance.
Okay. I actually came a bit late to academic staff governance. I have been on campus or was on campus since 1974, but my first formal role in academic staff governance was 1993 when I was appointed to the Area Review Committee for Administration, Student Services, and Library. And I chaired that committee from 1997 then till 2001. The area review committees are set up to review packets nominating academic staff members for indefinite status. And so our job is to review those packets to then to recommend to the appointing dean whether we agree that indefinite status should be provided. That exposure to academic staff governance allowed me to connect more widely across campus than I had before. I had certainly worked across the libraries and across the School of Education and was beginning to work some with IT folks on campus, but I worked more broadly. And I know one of the things that I did during my time as chair was meet with the chairs of the other three committees to discuss the processes for the indefinite status appointment, just to make certain that we were consistent across the four committees and we were also being as clear as possible. So even though that was my first foray into formal academic staff governance, it did allow me to begin making the connections that I think are a very important part of my history on campus and of academic staff governance.
Can I jump in here with a follow-up question?
Sure.
To that? So, sort of big in the news right now is the idea of tenure for faculty. Is this the equivalent for tenure for academic staff?
It is similar to tenure for academic staff, although there are some substantial differences, one of which is the operational area may be more more narrowly defined. So I was fortunate in that when I was awarded indefinite status, my operational area was the School of Education. Other individuals might have an operational area that is very narrow within a specific unit or department. There was actually a time in the 90s when the general library system was using indefinite status in the same way that, in a parallel way to the tenure process, in that every new hire was expected to attain indefinite status within 7 years, just as faculty members are expected to attain indefinite status within 7 years. But that made for a heavy workload for this committee, but it also resulted in an imbalance across the campus in terms of academic staff with indefinite status, and the general library system no longer has that policy. Another difference is that although indefinite appointment is available across the campus, it is much more, other than the GLS instance, much more narrowly used, and the deans of the schools and colleges have much more discretion in terms of how extensive indefinite status would be within their school, college, or division.
And I've talked about this with other folks in the libraries, particularly about the idea that there's not a lot of, at least during my time, there hasn't been a lot of librarians going out for indefinite appointment. But it sounds like during your time on the committee, except for this sort of GLS exception,
right,
there wasn't a lot of people going
there,
through
for... It really varied by school, college, and division. I haven't looked at the statistics in a number of years, but I think it has, as more budget constraints have gone through, my impression is that the number of individuals with indefinite appointment, indefinite status, is on the decline. I believe there was more during the time I was chairing that area review committee than would be the case today.
And I know you said it right off the bat, but besides libraries, what were your other responsibilities within that area review committee?
It's administration, student services, and libraries.
Okay. All right, so you were chair of that from 97, you said, to 2001?
That's correct.
So after that, did you... what did you do or did you do in terms of academic staff governance?
The next thing I did was I was a member of the ad hoc ASEC Committee on Longer Term Appointments, and that was in 1999. I was recommended for that committee by Ann Wallace, who knew of my work because she was also in the School of Education. And that committee looked at clarifying and promoting the various longer term appointments that were available to academic staff. Indefinite appointment certainly was one, multi-year appointments, rolling horizon appointments. And that work allowed me to connect with ASEC because we presented our report to ASEC, but also to connect with the Personnel Policy and Procedures Committee because our recommendations then were incorporated into academic staff policy and procedures for clarifying the procedure for longer term appointments and also putting into place regular university review of academic staff for longer term appointments.
So you said that was an ad hoc committee. Was there a leadership structure within the committee or was it just a group of people?
It was an ad hoc committee, but it was appointed by ASEC. I do not remember who the chair was. Ann Wallace may have been the chair, but I'm not certain of that. But we were a committee appointed by ASEC rather than a standing committee of the academic staff governance. We were an ad hoc committee appointed by ASEC to focus specifically on that issue.
Just jotting down a note here. So was this then your first, even though it was appointed by ASEC, you weren't on ASEC, but was this your first time that you started interacting with ASEC?
That committee, and then also in 1999, I was elected to the Compensation and Economic Benefits Committee, which is a standing committee for academic staff governance, and was a member of CEBC, its acronym, for 4 years. And as part of my responsibilities as a member of that committee and later chair, although I can't remember my exact dates as chair, the members of the committee would take turns attending ASEC meetings to report on the activities of CEBC. So in the 99-2003 period, I was attending ASEC meetings once a month or every 6 weeks so that I began to see ASEC operations up close at that point. I also began learning more about academic staff governance across the UW system because I was the representative from the campus CEBC group to the UW Systems Compensation and Economic Benefits Committee. And that those meetings, which were a couple of times a year, and UW system administrators would talk about proposed changes or adjustments in the benefits package that the legislature was looking at or that the UW system was considering implementing. So it again expanded my horizons beyond the campus.
I think you've alluded to it a couple of times here with the talking about the acronym CEBC, the standing committee you're on, but I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit more specifically about what that committee did.
As the Compensation and Economics Benefits Committee, its role was to look at issues primarily issues regarding benefits that were available across the campus. And so we would look at the benefits that were provided to academic staff as compared to benefits provided to classified staff and look at issues of equity. We would hear concerns from individuals about additional benefits or areas of benefits that the campus might want to address. I believe, and again, this was a few years ago, I believe one of the things that we did discuss at that time was looking at the benefits that are available to retirees, and we would talk about both sort of the formal benefits of working at the university and some of the, and then also of communicating some of the informal benefits, such as access to rec sports, access to the libraries, the child care services that are available to campus employees. And part of our job was to monitor the benefits that were available, but also part of our role was to communicate benefits to individuals.
And would you do that through your reporting to ASEC?
We would do that through our reporting to ASEC and to the Academic Staff Assembly. Technically, the standing committees in academic staff governance are appointed or are report to the Academic Staff Assembly, but as their coordinating body, ASEC, often in reality, is where the reports will begin, or the initial discussion of items that we'll be working with will begin. But our formal reports would be provided to the Academic Staff Assembly.
Okay. So it looks like you were at a couple of different committees in the late 90s, early 2000s, including chairing the Area
Right.
Review Committee. So after that, as we get into the early aughts, if you will.
Okay.
Where were some of the next places you went to for academic staff governance?
It's sort of as a an aside. During all of this time, I was involved in the academic staff mentoring program, which was not a formal academic staff governance standing committee at that point. That did not happen until like 2011, 2012. So my efforts in terms of academic staff governance were with the mentoring program, which began relatively small, but we would recruit individuals to serve as mentors to new academic staff on campus, then encourage new academic staff to request to be assigned a mentor. Mm-hmm. Do the matching for them, plan programs to bring the pairs together, ask individuals to help us assess the effectiveness of the program, And so I did that for a number of years. I don't have the exact years because it wasn't a formal committee, as well as serving as an academic staff mentor, I believe, for 8 years. So I was on the committee, but then also did mentoring of new academic staff members. But my next formal foray into academic staff governance was being elected to the Academic Staff Executive Committee in 2005. And I was in ASEC from 2005 until I retired in 2010. And I was the vice chair from 2009 through 2010.
So what are the things, once you're on ASEC, what are the... what are your main tasks or main jobs?
The main responsibilities of ASEC are to work with the standing committees of academic staff governance, to serve as a liaison between the administration and academic staff, to develop strategic goals and directions for academic staff governance for approval by the Academic Staff Assembly, to develop the monthly agendas for the Academic Staff Assembly, to appoint academic staff members to shared governance committees, and to develop the slate of nominees for the Academic Staff Nominations Committee. So those are major areas of responsibility.
It sounds like a lot of work. I mean, in terms of sort of balancing, you know, your campus job with this, did you keep track or have a rough idea of, you know, how many hours a week or how many hours a month you would be working on academic staff governance?
Well, we met 4 hours a week, just as ASEC, so that it is a substantial commitment. And like most other academic staff, I wasn't working a 40-hour week anyway, and so it was just, I was working much more than 40 hours a week, and so it was just, you worked till the job was done. A lot of our work would take place within the weekly meeting, but there were a number of things that I remember working on outside of the weekly meetings. One of the areas that I took some leadership on was developing stronger orientation for new members at the Academic Staff Assembly. The Standing Committee on Communications as part of academic staff governance also was developed during my time on ASEC, and I actually worked with the initial members of that committee to develop their charge to find the initial members of the committee who were appointed members before then it was formally adopted as a committee and members who were elected, and to work on a total revision and redevelopment of the academic staff website, including the development of a short video talking about who are academic staff and what are the roles. So it probably took, I don't know, maybe 10 hours a week of time, but that certainly wasn't one quarter of the time I was spending on my work at the, on my professional life.
Okay. So I came here in 2007. So I just know by osmosis that there were a couple of big things that happened during, your time here on ASIC. One was. and I can't remember exactly, I'm sort of blanking on how to phrase it, but it was the, I get basically the effort of unions to try to...
The unit clarification?
Yeah, unit clarification.
Yes.
So, if you would talk about that a little bit.
The unit clarification was, as you alluded to, an effort by the established labor unions to identify academic staff positions which they felt more appropriately should be classified staff positions and therefore be moved into class, move the position and the individual into classified staff positions that would then be represented by the various unions on campus, our unions that were part of state service. And that was not well received by academic staff governance, nor by most individuals who actually received a letter from the unions saying that their position had been identified as one that was more appropriately classified staff, and that they would be, that the unions would be working to move these to classified staff and therefore into the unions. The academic staff assembly had a couple of very spirited discussions and indeed passed a resolution against the entire unit clarification effort. There was also kind of in parallel with that discussion about the unionization of academic staff and faculty, but the legislature had determined that academic staff and faculty could not unionize. There was a brief period where the legislature says they, you know, I believe there was a brief period with the legislature under Governor Doyle said, yes, they could unionize, but then as we are all aware, Act 10 has taken that opportunity away. So the unit clarification, I think, did not move forward because the individuals involved and the members of academic staff governance were quite active in communicating to the administration that it was very important for the individuals in these identified positions to remain within the academic staff environment. And I think it really helped us to clarify some of the differences in terms of academic staff in that a number of these were IT titles. And you could look at an instructional technology title as, or an instructional technology position as, you've seen one instructional technology position, you've seen them all. But there are many, many positions that are IT positions appropriate to academic staff positions because there really is a deep need for an understanding of the instructional and or research process, that the same kinds of technology solutions that may be appropriate in a commercial environment are not going to be appropriate in a research environment or in an instructional environment, that for IT systems to be designed and delivered and supported in a way that really fosters the role of the university, you need people who have that academic background, have the credentialing, have the understanding of the role of IT in instruction and research particularly. So many, and as I said, many of the positions that were identified for unit clarification were actually people that by that point were reporting to me because my unit had extended beyond library services into information information technology and media development. And so I saw a lot of that very, very close, and it was very personal for members of my staff.
I might get back to that. But the other the big thing that happened during the time that you were on ASIC that I was here too was the new Badger partnership, or at least one of the big things.
Okay.
There might be more. But I wonder if you could talk about what, if any, memories you have of that. Although, you know, now that I think about it, it might be after your time, because it happened somewhat concurrently to what was going on. So that's more of a 2011 thing.
Right. That was Biddy.
Right.
Yeah.
And you had retired.
I had retired. I retired in 2010.
Okay.
Yeah. Another big thing that did happen, that you're right, that was after my time. Another thing that did happen, and during the time that I was on ASEC, was there was a change in what was then known as backup appointments. When a leadership or at-will position is filled on campus by an like chancellor, provost, you know, by somebody that is focused on totally on the faculty side of what the campus does, those individuals, when they come to campus, not only are appointed to their position, but they're also appointed, receive a faculty appointment in a specific school or college. It used to be, before there was very bad press about somebody who misused his backup appointment, it used to be the case that individuals who came to this campus for a position like the director of housing or the registrar or other at-will positions, even in my position in the School of Education, that was an at-will position, meaning I could be dismissed at any time and without a backup appointment. Upon dismissal, I would be out the door. The value of a backup appointment was it gave job security to individuals who were in these positions and might be dismissed because of a change of leadership within their school or college. Following, it was Paul Barrows incident, you may have.
The name sounds
okay.
Familiar.
Paul Barrows was an administrator who reported directly to the chancellor. And he had an at-will appointment, but he also had a backup appointment. There were accusations or intimations of sexual harassment, of him taking extended paid leave that he wasn't entitled to. And then, so when he was dismissed, he tried to revert to his backup appointment. And eventually, I believe the university just was able to sever connections with him. But the entire incident led to some very bad press for the university. Now, why would you have something called a backup appointment? Why would you want to keep somebody on staff that is has been so deleterious for the university? And so the backup appointments were eliminated. For a time, we they were eliminated for people being hired from outside the state or outside the university. Now, if an individual is promoted from within, they may have what is now called a coterminous appointment, in that they will have another job title to go back to. But if you come in from the outside, there is no opportunity for a coterminous or a backup appointment. And at the time, I know we were very concerned about the potential impact of the university on recruiting strong leaders for administrative units from outside the university. I don't know if a study has been done to see if it had an impact or if all of the other political and financial challenges that the university has faced has really made it impossible to look at that factor in isolation.
So did you end up with a coterminous appointment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then after this, so you were part of, so there was a change in the backup appointment basically due to this one example.
Mm-hmm.
And then the change happened. The change eliminated it for people on the outside, but gave the opportunity for people on the inside.
On the inside, yes.
So what was your other, what did your coterminous appointment?
My coterminous appointment was senior academic librarian, which basically meant that if a new dean came into the School of Education and did not want me to serve as in my director position, I would have a senior academic librarian position within the School of Education.
Now, was that something that like an academic staff person would have to be aware of, that that was a possibility, or was that something that ASIC helped identify people who had those, or did it just sort of shift between, once this happened, instead of a joint appointment, it was called a coterminous appointment?
And once this happened, instead of a backup appointment, it was called a coterminous appointment. In fact, we were, I remember Steve Lund very firmly telling ASEC, backup appointments no longer exist. But individuals who are promoted to at-will positions may, from within the university, may have a coterminous appointment. And I think, in terms of the backup appointments, it was fairly well understood by administrators who would, and deans and directors who would appoint somebody to an at-will position, that there would be a backup appointment and now a coterminous appointment to go along with that.
Okay. So, and I don't know this for fact, but for example, a university librarian comes in from the inside. In theory, he would be university librarian, and I think it's also like vice provost for libraries.
Right.
In theory, he might have a coterminous position.
Right.
So if the provost came in and wanted a different university librarian.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. But if somebody had been hired from outside for that position, there is no. They are truly at will.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else about your time at ASIC? Any sort of big major issues that you haven't touched on?
Let's see. Well, there was a transition from John Wiley to Biddy Martin, and we were, as is always true, ASIC was involved as part of that search committee. There was the beginnings of campus discussions on reorganizing the research enterprise, and I believe that has just it really has now been implemented. There was major concerns about the value of having the grad school and university research as essentially one unit, and the impact on academic staff is that there are so many academic staff members who are a part of the research enterprise on this campus, and there was concern that pulling them too far away from graduate education would lessen their opportunity to work more widely with grad students.
Okay. So unless there are other things you want to talk about there, I'd like to sort of wrap this part
okay.
up with sort of a question about, it sounds like really the second half, or maybe about the second half of your career, there was an involvement in academic staff governance to go along with your sort of day to day.
Yes.
How do you feel that, this is a sort of a big, broad question, how do you feel that influenced that second half of your career, being involved more deeply in academic staff governance?
Up until that point, most of my experience with the administration had been with the administration within the School of Education or with the library administration. As I got more involved in academic staff governance, I was involved with in meetings with the provost, with the vice chancellor for administration, with the associate vice chancellor, trying to get my titles right here, with Steve Stern, the associate vice chancellor for faculty and staff issues. And so I had more of an involvement with the upper levels of the administration, and also gained more knowledge about the wide variety of programs and services and areas of study and responsibilities and skills and just the overall complexity of this campus. Even when I was not involved in academic staff governance, I certainly was not isolated within the School of Education, but I saw many more roles that people played, and had a much broader understanding of all of the issues that individuals were working with. And until you asked that question, I realized that about this same time, I was nominated by my dean, Chuck Reed, to be a member of the inaugural class of the Frye Institute, which was a national institute sponsored by the Council on Library and Information Resources and EDUCAUSE to bring together librarians, IT staff, faculty, and administrators to look at issues in the integration of library services and technology and higher education. So I was involved in that inaugural institute, and that also influenced what I was seeing happening in my ability and interest in recognizing the broader issues on campus. The Frye Institute was a 2-week residential institute, so with speakers from universities around. Every day we would have like 2 or 3 keynote speakers, and we then also worked on the summary project when we returned from the institute. And even today I'm on the listserv for the Frye Institute, and a lot of informal discussion about higher education issues. So it was, I hadn't really thought about it till now, but that exposure through the Frye Institute to a wider scope for higher education, and my wider exposure to higher education through academic staff governance were occurring much at the same time.
Okay. Maybe 2 more things about academic staff, and then I think due to time we'll probably wrap up
okay.
today. The first is, and I think you may have answered this indirectly in your last couple answers, but what would you say, or how would you perhaps influence you know, young mid-career or late academic staff person who's never been involved in campus governance, what would be your sort of pitch to them about why it's important to be involved?
I think it's important to be involved in academic staff governance because it helps you more fully understand the institution that you're a part of and how that institution works, and therefore how that institution impacts your everyday life. From the personnel policies that academic staff governance looks at, to the monitoring of compensation and economic benefits, to the development of professional development opportunities, to mentoring, those are all areas that impact you, where you sit today. And by becoming involved, you can begin to shape some of those issues. When I was, and we'll get into this in more detail in another time, but when I was interim secretary of the academic staff, the opportunity for ASEC to represent the interests and needs of academic staff as a whole to campus administration, but also to administrators in specific areas of the university, was extremely valuable. And one of the things that we initiated was inviting members of the committees on academic staff issues, who are the local academic staff representatives, to join ASEC when they met with deans from a particular school or college, so we could facilitate discussion and help that local level to bring issues to their dean in an environment where other academic staff were there to support that discussion.
Okay. So my last question for this time is something you just addressed, and we talked about it briefly in that really short interview we did, and that was you becoming the interim secretary of academic staff. So it'll be a little reiteration from the last interview, but I wonder if you could talk about your path to get to that and then what you did.
Essentially what happened was Donna Silver, who was the secretary of the academic staff, was having some major health issues. And when I was first approached to become the interim secretary, I believe it was in April of, I'll have to check the dates, 2013? Yeah, that sounds about right.
You interviewed for us in 2013.
Okay,
so to 2013.
Okay, so it was the spring of 2012 when I was first contacted, and the thought at that time was that it would be a very short-term position. They were hoping Donna's health issues would resolve and she would come back to her position, and wanted somebody with recent experience in academic staff governance, and I had been on ASEC just 2 years previously, so it seemed to be a good fit. Unfortunately, Donna's health issues did not resolve as quickly as they had hoped and as Donna hoped, and I was interim secretary of the academic staff from 2012 through July of 2013, when Heather Daniels was appointed the new secretary of the academic staff. So essentially they came to me because I was a recent retiree with experience in academic staff governance.
So, I mean, it sounds like, and I mean this with no disrespect, that you were sort of a short-term placeholder, just to make sure things kept operating. When was it that you discovered or you were told that that was not going to be the case?
Um, I will have to check my notes on this, but I think it was the November-December time frame that I realized it was not going to be the case. And my appointment actually had increased from half-time to three-quarters time. And then it became apparent that Donna was not going to be coming back as quickly. And then by December, Donna realized she was not going to be able to return to the position. And so I then agreed to stay on until the position was filled, and the position then was filled in July, that following July. So a very short-term position. I ended up being in for 14 months. Mm-hmm. So,
were there any, throw the word out, sort of major issue or initiatives that you tried to do during your brief, but not as brief as you thought it was going to be, time?
Well, yes. During the same time period, the major issue that ASEC was working with was the HR redesign. And so ASEC was meeting much more frequently, more than once a week, needing to respond very quickly to academic staff issues in the HR redesign strategic plan. So I was doing a lot to support that. In terms of some specific initiatives, one of the aspects of the HR redesign that has since come to fruition was that classified staff were going to have be represented in governance for the first time. And there was also a changeover in the secretary of the faculty position. So we sort of had all of this coming together at the same time, and I initiated discussions with Andrea Painling, who was the secretary of the academic, or secretary of the faculty, and with Daryl Bazell, who would be working with the classified staff governance as it moved forward, about doing more to coordinate the work across the three offices. I felt this was important because most of the documentation in terms of appointments to shared governance committees was in paper form or in a very antiquated spreadsheet. And that led to the secretary of the faculty and the secretary of the academic staff basically maintaining duplicate records, repeating one another's work in terms of appointment letters, some occasional confusion about membership on various shared governance committees. And I figured with one more unit, classified staff governance coming in, that would heighten the confusion. And I don't know, and so we had some discussions. I know that Daryl Bazell was quite interested in supporting some integration. I don't know how that has progressed. I do know that one small step that was taken is that there is now a web page that lists, that essentially serves as a portal to shared governance on campus. And that was one small piece of this. The classified secretary of classified staff governance office was, in order to foster this collaboration, was located directly across from the secretary of the academic staff governance. So that was one thing that I worked on. The other thing that I worked on is I worked very closely with the Communications Committee because it was time for a total revamp of the academic staff website. And so we moved forward on that. And I also worked with ASEC to reorganize the physical space used by the Secretary of the Academic Staff to make it more welcoming and to also provide some meeting space that was more accessible to academic staff governance units. So that's what I did in those 14 months.
Okay, great. There is more I would like to ask, but okay. I think we've covered. It's a sort of a nice place to stop.
Yes.
And as I said before we turn this on, I always reserve the right to ask people to come back. So I will be asking you to come back. But this ends the interview with Joanne Carr. So, Joanne, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
All right. You're very